hope you guys will be a part of these next 2 weeks of helping us finish this up. Well, we are in a series called Messy Me, and we've been talking about the messes that we get in. We've all been in a mess. We've all made a mess. We've all seen a mess or two, and we know what a mess looks like because we're a mess ourselves. And you know, I remember I was singing all of my messes in this series, messes that I've made, and I remember one in particular that was pretty costly. My first car was a Ford Escort ZX2. It was a 5-speed. It was red. It was beautiful. Bought it from my uncle in Texas who owns a car lot. My dad's uncle who owns a car lot down there in Texas. My dad took a train down there, picked it up, drove it back. It was just this beautiful red. It was perfect for a teenager. Had put a big Fox Racing sticker in the back window because that was cool back then, you know, in middle school. And so, but that was my first car. And I remember one day I took it to get a wash, and I took it to the car wash in O'Fallon. One of those car washes, you know, with the big hose gun that makes you feel like a Ghostbuster, you know? And so I got out to wash my car, and this girl called me on my Motorola Razr flip phone. You remember those? You know what I mean? You were real cool if you could flick it open until the day that your screen just cracked and flew across the room. So this girl called me, right? And, you know, there's a girl involved. You know, this isn't, you know, this is the day and age where if somebody calls you, you got to take this opportunity, right? And so I was like, I can do both. I can do both at the same time. So I flipped that phone open. Hey, girl. You know, what are you doing? Washing my car. You know, so I start spraying my car down and everything and start washing it. And I'm talking to her. And I wanted to stay on the phone with her, right? And so I washed my car for like an extended 15 minutes. I just kept throwing quarters in. This was like a $40 car wash. All right, so I just keep going and going and going. I talk to her for a really long time. And then it finishes, I hang up the phone, I close it, and I go to put the squirt gun back in the thing, and I get looking at the monitor with all the little dials, and I realize that for 25 minutes, I washed my car on wax. Yeah. And I went, oh. And so I drove it home, and as I drove it home, it began to dry, and my beautiful red paint job on my Escort just turned into a haze. Just a terrible, terrible white haze. And I called one of my buddy who detailed cars, and I was like, you got to come over here. You got to come look at this. And he looked at it, and he said, oh, this is easy. All we got to do is wax it more and buffer it. And so we went to AutoZone and we tried a little bit and it shined right up in that little spot. And he said, see, this is all we got to do. So we got a whole bunch of wax and we start going to town and we started buffering it and wiping it in and doing everything. And then as it dried, it just got worse. We should have known that $10 little bottle of wax was not going to get it done. And so guess what had to fix it? A $3,000 new paint job. That is what ended up fixing it. And you know, that's exactly what messes do when we try to fix it the cheap way, when we do try to do it ourselves, when we try to do it the quick way, is it ends up actually becoming a disaster. And we've talked about that in this series, that a disaster is when something has to be redone, replaced, rebuilt. And that's exactly what happens when we don't address the mess properly. And that's what we've been talking about this series, is that we've all made a mess. And many times we try to act like we're okay on the outside. We try to cover it up. We try to pretend. We try not to let our messes be known. And we talked about that's called a hot mess is what that is. It's where I try to look attractive even though inside I'm a mess. But what we talked about is how we shouldn't hide our messes, that we should let them draw us to God, that God actually has drawn near to us because of our messes. It's why he sent his son, Jesus Christ, is because he knew we were a mess and he knew the messes we were going to make. And so our messes shouldn't be something that we try to cover up. They should be something that we address and they should draw us to God. And what we started talking about a little bit last week is what happens when we draw near to God is he begins a new work in us. He begins to transform us from the inside out. And it's a lifelong process that lasts forever. And what is changing inside of us is how we love. God wants to transform. If there's anything quantitative that we could really wrap our minds around what God is doing inside of us, he's trying to change the way that we love. And you know, it's interesting when we talk about that. Sometimes we know this in our head, but we don't know what it looks like. And so this morning, that's what I want to give you a little bit better picture about. You know, actually, when Jesus was asked, what is the greatest command? What is the greatest thing I could do? And they were actually trying to trap him because there were so many Old Testament commands and laws and things you were supposed to do. They're like, give me one. And so Jesus kind of summed it up. And he said, here's the greatest thing you could ever do. Here's the most important thing you could ever do. Here's the thing that you're probably going to be judged by, but here's also the thing that's going to make your life better. And this is what Jesus said. We're going to use Luke. It's found in several different translations of the Bible, but we're going to look at Luke. One day, an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question. What should I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus replied, what does the law of Moses say and how do you read it? And he says, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said, right, do this and you will live. This is the greatest command, to love your neighbor and to love God. To love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, we've talked about this a lot of times at our church because this is one of our cornerstones of what we believe is important as a follower of Jesus, is that these two commands, it's not two commands, it's one command. It's like a coin that has two sides. You cannot do one without the other. If you really love God, then you will love your neighbor. And you can't truly love your neighbor without understanding and knowing the love of God. And these two things are quantitative. It's like a math formula, okay? You can't have X without Y to get Z. You need X and Y to get Z. You like that, Wes? Math teacher? Using some math today. It's the only thing I remember, okay? But you need the two things to get Z. You can't do one without the other. And if you miss one, you're really missing out on the other. Love God and love your neighbor. Now, the expert in religious law had the same question that probably you and I have from time to time. He moved on and he asked this question because he wanted to justify his actions. So then tell me this, who's my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Tell me, who is it exactly that I have to love? Tell me exactly who is it that I'm supposed to care for and that I'm supposed to love as myself. And I think you and I, we all have to ask ourselves that question. We do naturally. Because you and I have seen a mess or two that's hard to love, haven't we? And you and I have always run into a mess and thought, is that really somebody that I'm supposed to love? You know, we've all had that person that our son or daughter dated, you know? And we thought, really, God? Am I supposed to love that kid? Because I don't know if I want my daughter dating him. I don't know if I want my son dating her. I don't know if I want them to be friends. I don't know if I want them together because I think that kid is just going to drag my kid down. I don't know if I'm supposed to love that mess right now, Lord. I mean, I don't know. I think he's kind of a punk. I think they're kind of a bad kid. Maybe that's not the kid that I'm supposed to love, you know? Or maybe it's somebody at work. And you're like, God, I can't love this mess. No, not this mess. This mess, they're dramatic. They tell these stories that are very, very long and drawn out. And I just want to scream, you're the problem, you know? And it's just, I can't take it anymore. And it's too much. And I just shake my head. I don't even know what to say. Actually, there's so many things I want to say, but I keep my mouth shut. And it's just, I don't know if that's the mess that I'm supposed to love, Lord? Or I don't know if it's that person who did that bad thing. God, I think that they're kind of getting what they deserve is what's happening. You know, I mean, they're a bad person. They did some bad things. I don't think you're talking about loving that mess because they're a bad guy and they did something that was wrong and so they're getting what they deserve. Or maybe it was a parent or a family member who betrayed you or who keeps doing the same thing every time you see him at the holidays, every time you get together, every time you talk to him. It's the same drama. It's the same mess. It's the same problems. And you've thrown up your hands and you said, I'm done. I don't need to do it anymore. I'm going to put you at an arm's distance because that's who you are. And I'm going to walk around you. I'm going to ignore you. I don't want anything to do with you. I'm going to avoid you in the break room. I'm going to avoid having to talk to you. I'm going to avoid having anything to do with you because you're a mess. See, it's easy to love our neighbor when we like our neighbor. I love my neighbor. He's sitting right there. He's a great person, all right? I can love that neighbor because they're a great person and they deserve love and they're lovable. But how do you love the neighbor that's really hard to love? How do you love the neighbor that's a mess? How do you love the family member that's a mess? How do you love the friend of your kid that's a mess? What do you do then? And so that's really what this guy was getting to. How do I love that neighbor? And am I really responsible for loving that neighbor as I love myself? Because that's a pretty tall order. And so Jesus answered the question with a story. And this story I want to share with you today and break it down. He shares it a little bit later, just a verse later. He says, this is what happened. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. And they stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. So this man, he's traveling, right? And many commentaries say that this actually could have been a true story because it was very common for this kind of incident to happen on this road. And so this might just be a story that Jesus knew of because he was the Son of God, and it might have actually been a true story, but it happened regularly. And this Jewish man, he was beat up and he was left for dead. I mean, he was very, very close to death. He wasn't just beat up and sitting there holding his stomach. He was half dead. And then a priest comes along. By chance, a priest came along, but when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. So this priest, what would happen in the priestly position is that the priest held this really, really important role. They were kind of like oil workers. It was a week on, a week off. And so he was traveling to the temple to serve his week's term. And what he would do is guard the Holy of Holies. It was a very prestigious role. It was a very honorable role. And what the priest would do is many times it's kind of like being a surgeon. You know how a surgeon like washes and sterilizes his hand before going into surgery and then he doesn't touch anything? That's what the priest would have basically done. He would have had his priestly garments on. He would have had his temple gear ready to go. He would have been cleaned. He would have been pure. He wouldn't have had any dirt on him, and he would have been ready to go. And so for him to go and help the man and to get involved with that, who's probably bleeding, probably hurt, probably needed to be picked up, probably would get his clothes dirty. I mean, it would really defile him. But you got to understand, Jesus gives the priest, you know, a little bit of credit. The priest was going to do something very, very good. Very, very important. Actually, in the Bible, Jesus doesn't really talk negatively at all about the priestly position. He really, really respected the priests and the job that they did. But yet still, Jesus said he should have helped the man. And that's a note we're going to get to a little bit later more in depth. But the priest was going to do something good, and yet Jesus expected him to stop, and he didn't. And you and I can do that sometimes. Or we use that as an excuse, is really the truth, is that we're supposed to do something for somebody else. We're supposed to love our neighbor, except we use this excuse, well, you know what, I've got something I've got to do that's more important, that's good. I've got to get to church, you know, and that's what's most important right now. Or I'm going to serve somewhere, I'm going to do something, I'm going to fulfill a responsibility. I'm not ignoring them because I don't like them or because I don't want to help them. I just can't right now. So Jesus, he looks at the priest and he says, this priest, man, he just walked around the other side. He just completely ignored him, just left him there for dead. And even though he was going to do something good, something important, something that I respect and I'd say good for you, he should have stopped and helped his neighbor. And then he goes on to the next person he came by. Then a temple assistant walked over and looked at him lying there, but he also passed on the other side. So then comes a temple assistant. A temple assistant was kind of the, you know, right-hand man to the priest. He would go and do all the laboring, the hard work. He would do all the things that the priest couldn't do to get their hands dirty, right? And this man comes by, and Jesus gives him a little bit of credit. He didn't just walk over, just totally avoid him, just walk completely around him. He actually went over to the man and looked down and kind of pitied him. And kind of looked at him and said, oh man, that stinks. You know what? I'll be praying for you, you know? And went along, but Jesus gave him a little bit of credit. But he ended up just walking away. He ended up not loving his neighbor. And you know what? You and I do that too sometimes. Sometimes we look at a mess, we look at a neighbor that we should love, and we don't actually do anything. We say, my sympathies. We say, I'll be praying for you, which 90% of the time is just something we say. We don't actually pray for anybody. But we say, I'll be praying for you, you know? We change our profile pic to let everybody know we're with you, you know? But we end up just looking at it, pitying it, going, that stinks. and then we end up on our way. We don't end up actually loving our neighbor. And that's exactly what this temple assistant ended up doing. He walked over, he looked at him, but he ended up still passing on the other side. Both of these two examples, the temple assistant and the priest, Jesus says, this isn't what I'm looking for. This isn't enough. It's not enough. I know you're on your way to something important, something good, something that's very honorable, but it's important to stop when you see your neighbor in need. I think it's great that you stopped and you pitied the man. You said you would pray for him, you know, you changed your profile pic, you know, you agreed that what happened to him was bad, but it wasn't enough. You should have stopped and you should have loved your neighbor. And then he gets to the example that's the right way to do it. He says, this is what I want. This is who you should be. This is what it means to love your neighbor. And it goes on in the next verse. And then a despised Samaritan came along. And when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him. Now, it says despised Samaritan. See, the man who was attacked was a Jew. And then a despised Samaritan came by. The Samaritans and Jews, they hated each other, right? This was a big racial war back then. And Samaritans were looked at as like half-breeds, and really Jews hated Samaritans, and so Samaritans in turn hated Jews, right? So there was a lot of racism and racial tension between the two groups. You weren't supposed to be seen together, and you most certainly wouldn't have any reason to help one another. But a Samaritan stops, and he sees the Jewish man, a man that he should have looked at and said, you're one of them. You're getting what you deserve. Your people, they've done so many bad things. Why in the world would I help you? Your ancestors have hated my ancestors. We haven't been good for a long time. He had no reason to help the Jewish man who had been attacked. But it says he stopped and he had compassion for him. Now, that doesn't mean he just looked down and he pitied him. Didn't mean he looked down and he said, I'll be praying for him. He looked down and he looked at the man and he said, you know what? This is someone who I am supposed to love. And he decided to act on that love that he had in his heart. And this is what it says he did next. Next, he went over to him, and the Samaritan man soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine, and he bandaged him. And then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn, where he took care of him. And the next day, he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, telling him, take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time that I am here. Now, I want to talk real quick. There's 4 things that I see going on in this scripture that tell us kind of what the Samaritan man did. The first thing that the Samaritan man did is he gave him his immediate emergency help. His immediate need was that he was dying, right? And so he needed immediate attention. He needed immediate help. And the Samaritan, he fulfilled that. Now, a lot of times when we see somebody who's a mess, right? We use this little line that we've learned in our culture. Well, what's it better to do, you know? To give a man a fish or to teach him how to fish? Well, of course everybody knows the answer to that. It's better to teach a man to fish. But have you ever tried to learn something when you're really hungry? It's impossible, right? Why is it an either-or type situation? Which one are you going to do? Are you going to give him a fish or teach him to fish? Can we not just change it? Can we not teach people how to fish while also feeding them fish, right? Is that okay? Can we change that, right? I mean, isn't that what it's like parenting 101, right? When you're teaching your kid like how to tie his shoes, did you just throw his shoes down at him and go, is it better to tie your shoes or to teach you to tie your shoes? Learn, child, right? No, you didn't do that. You did it for him a couple times, right? You showed him how to do it. You worked with him. That's what you do, right? And that's the same way we should treat people who are in need, who are a mess. We use it as an excuse too many times of saying, well, we're not getting anywhere, you know. Why should we feed their stomachs? Why should we help them with their needs? Why should we give them a tax relief? I mean, I think they just need to learn their lesson. No. The way that we can love our neighbor is by doing both. But let's be honest, there are immediate needs and concerns that people have in this world. There is immediate emergency help that people need at this time. And if you wait to tomorrow, it's going to be too late. There are things people need today, and there are things that we can teach them and equip them with tomorrow. That's one of the reasons why we partner with Bright Futures here in our community, and I'm on that committee, is because, you know, look, there are some things that need to change in the Bright Futures program, and we're being a part of those changes, where we don't just need to feed bellies, we need to teach people how to get jobs, we need to educate them, we need to equip them. But let's be honest, there are homeless teens and children and hungry bellies right now, and they need to be filled, and that's why we're a part of the Buddy Bag program. And that's why we do things like the Affordable Christmas Shop, is because there are immediate emergency needs that need to be filled now. And that's one of the ways we can love our neighbor. And that's one of the ways the Samaritan loved his neighbor. The second thing that he did is he took him where he could be cared for, right? Some of us use the lame excuse. Well, what could I do? You know, I don't know how to help him. I mean, somebody more equipped needs to do that. Somebody more knowledgeable can help him. There's nothing I could do. And the Samaritan knew that as well. I don't think the Samaritan was a paramedic, right? I mean, I don't know the last time you put, you know, olive oil on the wounds, but I think that was a dumb move, you know? I mean, he should have put some alcohol on that thing or something, you know? I mean, clearly he didn't know what he was doing. You know, but that didn't stop him from helping. And here's the thing he did. He didn't know what to do. He was not as knowledgeable, but he got him to where he could be cared for. So don't let that be an excuse. When you look at somebody in your need or you look at a mess and you go, this mess is too big for me. I don't know what to say. I don't know how I would help them. I don't know how to fix their marriage. I don't know how to give them advice. It's okay. You know what you could do, a way you could love your neighbor? Get them somewhere where they could be cared for. Get them to a counselor. Get them to a doctor. Get them who knows their financial ins and outs. Get them to somebody who could help them create a budget. Get them to somewhere who could help them get a job. Get them the care that they need. That's exactly what the Samaritan did. And he models for us a way that we can also love our neighbor by getting people the care and in the hands of the people who can actually help them. And then the third thing he did, he took care of his financial burdens. This is an easy one. To help people when they're in need. Now, when people need financial help, people need help getting back on their feet, people need to help buying groceries, buying food, that we can help them. You know, we always talk about, you know, money like, you know, well, why is it always about money? Because we all know money's a big part of it, man. Money buys doors, you know? And guess what? At the end of each year, tags need to be renewed. You know, tires fall off of cars. You know, different things happen. Water heaters break. Kids get sick, right? Trust me, I'm waiting on a bill for 2 ambulance rides that my kid took 2 weeks ago. I can't wait. I told Kate if there's any surgeries she wants this week or this year, that the deductible has probably been met. I'm getting calf implants. That's my plan, all right? So if you see Pastor busting out of his jeans, I got implants. You know, but we can help people because let's be honest, a lot of it is money, guys. A lot of it is determined and depends on money. Things cost, and things in this life cost money. And I love how the Samaritan, he took care of his financial burdens. He took care of them and took what he needed. And then I love this part, last part. He offered further assistance if it was necessary. The Samaritan didn't just drop him off and go, good job, man. And then he went and Facebooked about it. You never believe what happened today. I loved my neighbor and I took care of him. No, it was not enough. You know what? He took it so much further than that. He looked at the innkeeper and he said, and look, if there's more that needs to be done, I'll do it. This was not the day where I earn my gold star and I feel good about myself and I go tell the world about it so that I can get a couple likes and people think I'm a good person. No, I'm in this for the right reasons. I love this person. I have compassion for this person. I'm not just going to fill the immediate need, the need that's now. I'm going to take it all the way. If there's anything else I can do, if there's any further assistance, if he needs a ride, if more needs to be taken care of, if he doesn't have a place to stay, if you decide you can't keep him anymore, I'm here for this person because I'm not about just the immediate need. I'm here for him. Because I care about him, because I love him. The Samaritan's actions totally encompasses what Jesus wants us to be, what he wants us to do. And so Jesus turned back to the religious leader, and he says this. He says, so now which of these three would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by bandits? Would you say it was the priest who had something more important that was totally good that he needed to do? Would you say it was the temple assistant who had pity on the man, who said a prayer for the man, who said, I'm so sorry? Or do you think it was the man who answered the immediate need, who got him the care that he needed, who took care of his financial burdens, who offered even more further assistance? And the man says, well, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said, so yeah, now go and do the same thing. This is what it means to truly love your neighbor. And on the same side of the coin, this is what it truly means to love God. It's to love your neighbor. So let me ask you a question. What is it that keeps us from loving our neighbor like the Samaritan? I think there are three things that probably keep us from loving the way that the Samaritan loved. The first one would be convenience, right? Let's just be honest. We're really, really busy people. We're like the priest and the temple assistant. We got somewhere we need to be, and it's important. I'm responsible. They're expecting me. I don't have time to stop and to love the messy people. I mean, they got themselves into this mess. I got somewhere I'm supposed to be. It would be wrong of me to be late. It would be wrong of me to stop. It would be, you know, wrong of me to get involved in this where there's somewhere else I'm supposed to be. There's a parent guy with his kid who came by this week, the church, wanting to look at our pews that we were selling. And so we were talking and everything, and we were trying to talk about a time he could come pick them up. And he said, man, he goes, oh, let me think about this. And he was looking through his phone and looking through his calendar. He goes, my kid, he's got soccer 3 nights this week. And he turned to me and goes, you remember when we were kids and, you know, practice was on Wednesday night and games were on Saturday morning? And, like, it only lasted 12 months, and then you were free, you know, and then another sport started, but it was like, it was Wednesday nights and Saturday mornings. That was it. He's like, now these kids, he's like, I've got soccer for 2 hours, 3 nights a week, and, like, if my kid doesn't do this, then he'll just be forgotten about. Then he can't play soccer. It's ridiculous. And, you know, that's how a lot of things go now. Our lives are busy, right? We have thing to thing to thing to thing. And here's the thing, is that most of us don't have time to love our neighbor. And that's a problem. We need to carve out time to intentionally make ourselves available to love our neighbor. Being busy is not an excuse that's going to cut it. When we go to heaven and we meet God and he goes, you know, why didn't you stop and help the messy person? Why didn't you talk to them? Why didn't you hear their story? Why didn't you take a 15-minute break? Why did you have to go to that next meeting? Why did you have to take that phone call? Why didn't you stop to have lunch with them? Why didn't you go and give them some money? Why didn't you go and take care of the need? Why didn't you go and serve when the church was out there serving? And we go, well, I was just too busy, Lord. It's not going to cut it. We've got to carve out time to be available. Where this block of time, there's nothing going on. What is it for? I have to be doing something. No, you don't. Make yourself available. I do that with my schedule every week. I have blocks of time and nights that are purposely cut out and open so that if anybody calls me or texts me and says, I need to talk, I need help, I need counseling, well then, boom, I've got a time for you. Because it would be very easy for me to just do and fill up my schedule. And somebody calls me, I go, I just don't see when, you know. I mean, let's do it 2 weeks from now. No, there are immediate needs going on right now. People need help now. I can't schedule them 2 weeks from now. They need counseling now or their marriage is going to fall apart. They need financial help now or they're not going to pay their bills and then their house is going to get foreclosed on. There are things that need to happen now. And we've got to cut out time to be available for people, to be there for our neighbors and to love them, because we've got to, convenience just isn't an excuse. The second reason I think sometimes we have a hard time being the Good Samaritan is comfort, because let's all be honest, getting in a mess is uncomfortable, right? Helping a messy person just makes you go, oh boy, right? Where you just scratch your head and you're like, why did I do this? We had, when I was a youth pastor in Nebraska, we had this kid, I've talked about him before, Bubba, right? I've shared stories about Bubba. Bubba was like the only black kid in town, lived with his grandma, brother was incarcerated, dad don't know where he was really, mom worked 2 jobs, like 10-hour shifts, was always gone. I think I met her like three times when I was for the 3 years that I lived there. But Bubba, man, Bubba was a project. You know, as soon as I got there, the secretary told me, "Now let me tell you about this one kid, Bubba," and told me all of his problems and all these things I need to be looked for. And I was like, okay. And so I immediately, as soon as I met Bubba, put my arm around Bubba, and Bubba was my guy. And we, Kate and I, we took care of Bubba. There was like five or six places he couldn't go in town because he had shoplifted there. I mean, he had all these restrictions on him. He always needed a ride everywhere we went. And I would always tell Bubba, Bubba, I was trying to teach him how to be responsible. Bubba, if you need a ride, you got to call me and you got to ask for a ride. Guess how many times Bubba called me and told me he needed a ride? Zero. It was always 10 minutes before that I was calling Bubba going, "Bubba, do you need a ride?" "Yeah." "Okay, Bubba, I'm on my way." You know, Bubba just was always getting into trouble. I remember we did this this teen fundraiser where we sold the boxes full of chocolate. You know, the Reese's and the Hershey's and stuff, and the kids would take the boxes of chocolate to school and, you know, sell them during lunch and stuff for a buck, and you'd raise money that way. I gave Bubba a box of chocolate. You know, $30 a box is what, you know, 30 bucks is what should come back. I gave Bubba a box of chocolate. He calls me 2 days later, and he goes, "Hey, we got a problem." I said, "What's that?" He goes, I ate all the chocolate. And I said, "Bubba, how many did you sell?" "One to my grandma, and then I ate the rest." I said, "Bubba, why'd you do that?" And I'm not kidding. This is not made up. This is what he said for me, word for word. He goes, "Man, you should have known better to give a black diabetic a box of chocolate." And I said, "Bubba, that's not an excuse, all right? It's not an excuse." I said, "But it's fine. I'll pay for it, Bubba. It's fine. I will pay for it. I bought all your pretend chocolate that's in your stomach now, all right? Go take your insulin." But, you know, he just was always in trouble. And he was always doing stuff. And nobody believed in him. As soon as I got there, people were like, "Scratch him off the list." But Kate and I, we stuck with him, and we did everything. And it was so uncomfortable. There were so many times we ended up shaking our head. But Bubba was the first male in three generations in his family to graduate high school. He ended up going to culinary school. He did something with all that chocolate eating. He ended up going to culinary school. He got a job at one of the diners that he used to be banned from because he shoplifted from there. And he ended up being the cook of the diner. Bubba wasn't easy. And it was super uncomfortable. But that kid needed to be loved. That kid needed special attention. That kid needed to be taken care of. And I don't know if Kate and I were the only ones who saw his potential or believed in him or just looked at him and had compassion. But, you know, thank God that we were there. And I'm not patting ourselves on the back. I wonder what would have happened to him if we wouldn't, because so many other people in the church had written him off and didn't care for him any longer. Just saw him as a loner. Just saw him as somebody who was getting what he deserved. But not us. And we've got to look at uncomfortable situations and people who we think, you know, I don't like that. And we've got to be willing to get involved in the mess. See, I think we have this idea that probably the entertainment industry has put into our culture and this our generation, and it probably started even before mine. But so many times we look at things, and our determining factor of whether or not we get involved is it going to be boring or is it going to be exciting? Is it going to be boring or is it going to entertain me? And we look at things like that. I think we look at church like that. Well, what's your church like? Is the music good? Do they have donuts? Do they have lights? Do they have fog machines? You know, is it going to be fun if I go? Can they make friends for me? You know, what's the deal? Is it going to be fun? Because if it's not going to be fun, I don't want to do it. Is it going to be boring or is it going to be fun? Here's the thing. The Christian faith is not about being entertained. Okay, you want to be entertained? Go watch Hugh Jackman in The Showman. I hear it's great, all right? But following Jesus is about being faithful. It's not about being entertained. And I hear people leave. I've been a part of many churches all my life. I've worked under many pastors. I was a pastor's kid. I've heard the line. I've heard it everywhere I've ever gone. Why are you leaving the church? Well, I'm bored. I'm bored. I'm not getting anything out of it anymore, you know? I'm not making any friends. Nobody's being my friend. Nobody's making friends for my little girl. The teen group is not exciting enough. They don't have friends. It's not fun. We don't like it here. We're just not getting anything out of it. And I go, well, of course you're not, because you're playing it safe. Because let me give you a guarantee. If you play it comfortable, you will get bored. okay? If you want to be comfortable, then I guarantee you, you will get bored. But if you want excitement, okay, if you want excitement, if you want to know what it's like and you want to grow and you want to know what it's like to grow in your faith and to grow in love and what it means to become like Jesus, then you're going to have to do some uncomfortable stuff. If you want to see the excitement of following Jesus, if you want to know how cool it is to bring somebody to Christ and to actually know that you put a brick on the wall of the kingdom and you were actually part of something that brought the kingdom to light, if you want that feeling and you want to know what that's like and you want some excitement in your life, then you are going to have to do some uncomfortable stuff. You're going to have to get out of your comfort zone and you're going to have to rely on God and you're going to have faith. Because the boring stuff only happens when you're faithless, when you're not putting yourself out there, and when you refuse to address the messy people that God is calling all around you. And then the last thing is this, control. I think a lot of us, we're like, y'all get involved. If I can control everything, you know, if I can guarantee that I can fix them, yeah, let me fix them. Let me tell you something right now. If you are going to go and love your neighbor and your mission is that you are going to fix them, you are going to lose, okay? Because your objective will be to fix them. You don't fix people. God fixes people. You don't change anyone. God changes people. You're not going to change their habits. You're not going to change their heart. You're not going to convince them to do what they ought to do. God is going to do all that. And I want you to know right now, before you get involved with any messy person, and I'm only telling you because I have failed, and I'm a living example because I've done it wrong too, is that you can't control people. It's not your job to fix anybody, and it's not your job to control anyone's actions or habits or what they do. It's your job to love. That's your job. Your job is to love the way the Samaritan did, to answer immediate needs, to take care of their financial burdens, to get them to the people who they need to be cared for, to offer any further assistance, to be a bended ear, to listen, to talk, to give a hug, to pray for, to share your story with them. But it's not to control anybody. You'll never be able to control anybody. And that goes for people you help. That goes for your kids. You can't control your kids. You can try as hard as you want. But you're just going to push people away. And you're just going to turn people off to religion and to Christianity because it's going to seem like somebody's trying to bend them into something that they don't feel like they can be yet. Don't try to bend people because if you do, they'll break. Let God change people. And let him transform them from the inside out in the same way that he's transforming you from the inside out. And know that in the same way that God has began a lifelong process inside your heart, that he doesn't expect you to have down tomorrow, he's going to do the same thing with them. He's going to begin something in them, and it's going to take time, it's going to take effort, and it's going to take patience. So be patient with them the same way that God has been patient with you. Because that pastor loved her. You need to know something about this church if you choose to be a part of it. In my head, this is the island of misfit toys. I feel specifically called to pastor the people who feel broken, who feel alone, who feel like outsiders, who feel like other churches have looked at them and judged them wrong and who have called them a mess and have not wanted to get their hands dirty with them, who have looked at people and pitied them and thought that some sins are greater than others and said, we don't want you here. I'm the pastor for the people who have no place to go. And I feel called to shepherd the lost and the people who are willing to talk and be open. I'm here for the people who feel like they have nowhere else to go. And just this week, I had somebody message me and go, here's what I do that you don't know about. Here's what I have going on in my life, and I'd love to know if I have a place in your church or if you'll take me. If I can just come and attend church at your church, if that's okay. And I said, I want you to know it's absolutely okay. You are loved here, you belong here, and you are happy to serve. It's amazing that we live in a culture and a day where people even have to ask that question. Is here's my messy stuff. Can I even come? Can I even walk in your doors? Will you take me? Can I belong here? Can I be a part of this? How horrible of a job have we done as Christians where people don't even know the answer to that question? And how unbelievable is it that there are churches where the answer that they would actually get is no? We are a church. Anchored Hope is a church, and I am a pastor for the people who have nowhere else to go. Because I want the thing to be that characterizes our church is how we love. Not just how we love God, but how we love people. Because I will tell you right now, I am a mess, and you're a mess too. And none of us should be hot messes and pretend like we have anything together, because none of us do. I'm going to invite the worship band to come back up, and we're going to close. But here would be my prayer for you. God is giving us this building and this opportunity because there are more Caitlins in the world. There are more Caitlins in the world, and there are more people who feel like they don't belong and they are not loved, who are hiding secrets and things that they think if anybody knew about, it would just hurt more people, it would get me in trouble, and they just keep it to themselves and they just allow themselves to be used and hurt and abused, all because they don't feel like they have anywhere else to go. I pray that this morning God would transform your heart how it needs to be transformed, and that this morning God would speak to you, because I want to be a church that is characterized on how we love God and how we love our neighbor, and both are equally important to me. Mm-hmm.